Hello and welcome to a mini series of podcasts designed to raise the issues facing all government organisations to tackle legacy IT and move towards digital transformation. I'm Simran Sahosa from the Government Digital Service, and across three podcasts, I'll be delving into real-life examples with professionals from across government. You'll hear the good, the bad and the ugly, and get practical advice on best practice. Each podcast is broken into three elements: technology, process, and people implications. In this podcast, we will focus on legacy IT contracts. Leaders can find themselves overseeing contracts that are decades old with little room to maneuver. Equally, without the right know-how, new contracts can leave us at risk of legacy IT or without the rights to our own data. For this podcast, on our panel, we will have Dan Webster, Suzanne Angel, and Chad Bond. Tell us about your role and experience in government.
Thanks, Simran. Hi, I'm Dan Webster. I lead the technology practice in the Government Commercial Functions Complex Transactions team. And we work with departments and big programs on some of their trickiest technology commercial issues.
So, hi, I'm Suzanne Angel. I'm an account lead at Kainos. I've been working government IT projects for nearly 20 years now, both as a consultant helping the government effectively on that side of the fence go and buy IT, and now as a supplier.
Hi, my name's Chad Bond. I'm from Government Digital Service. Me and the team are responsible for assuring the design, development and delivery of all of government's technology and public-facing digital services against government standards, the Technology Code of Practice and the Service Standard.
Great, thank you. So to begin with, Dan, what advice do you have to give to senior civil servants who find themselves in charge of a contract where legacy IT is a problem?
So if I give you an example, in the complex transactions team, we work with the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency on a replacement for their radio network. So that's a blue line network that's really vital to keeping people safe at sea. The old network was past its end of life. Maintenance taking place with, by getting things out of other pieces of kit and so on. And a new, more up-to-date solution was needed. And some of the things that they did really well were identifying the right information about the current state, where were they truly at, and being really clear about what they wanted out of the new network, and then understanding how that change would happen. On the other hand, I think one of the mistakes that folks made, I've seen a lot of departments really sort of rushing to market before they've really understood the challenge, and that tends to end in pretty bad outcomes. So I think we tend to fetishize getting out into a procurement rather than thinking about the end-to-end program. You've got to have a strategy and a plan. And if you don't, it's going to take longer and be harder than it needs to.
Chad, what support is there for leaders who find themselves already in a legacy IT contract?
People coming in trying to manage this legacy estate, there's actually a lot of support packages available. One, it's more true than false that actually they're not the only one going through this, and actually there's a lot of duplication across government in terms of similar leaders facing similar issues, for example. So there's a network of digital and technology leaders out there facilitated by Government Digital Service that they can harness and have peer support and help. More centrally within the Cabinet Office, there's a range of teams, both within Government Digital Service, Government Commercial Function and Crown Commercial Services, to actually come together. And it's important to highlight that this relationship shouldn't be seen as adversarial. We are all one government and we all have vested interests for the taxpayer, for the leaders trying to run these programs to try and make these things a better place. So there's a bit of dialogue around coming together to face this common issue. What I'm quite inspired by recently is several senior leaders in government over the last year actually really looking hard at the outcomes that contracts are supposed to deliver in the outcome space and actually challenging suppliers to ensure that they are delivered, and where they're not, looking at plans of remediation or even or auditing, for example, and then working quickly to establish if that's the right vehicle, if that's the right relationship going forwards, and if not, then looking at the alternatives, which in some case may actually mean supplier switching. If ultimately the current incumbent is performing, for example, leaders shouldn't be shy or afraid of ensuring that they deliver. And there's a range of support packages out there facilitated by the centre.
Suzanne, as the voice of the supplier on this podcast, how might a supplier react to being challenged?
So I think, I mean, when presented a challenge, I mean, bear in mind we are commercial organisations. So what we look at is we look at the benefits to the customer ourselves about whether the risks of delivering that solution effectively outweigh the benefits. And when we think about risk, it's not just sort of commercial risk, it's the reputational risk. And often we're exposed to information in a competitive tender. And I think I completely agree with Dan. If we get something lands on our desk which appears confused and unclear, the strategy for the change isn't there, the understanding the as is isn't there, fundamentally supply, what you may find is we don't bid. Now, I know we're going to talk about tendering later, but the red flag for me, the things aren't going well. If you were sat there as a customer, is you've gone out pretending you come back, you're not getting as many responses as you expected, getting a huge disparity on price. And I know when I've sat on the customer side of the fence, you get to the point you've got one customer, one supplier's coming at 1 million, others have come in at 20 million, because you've really not set out what it is that you want. And I can think of a number of situations where as a supplier, we have been really, really, really excited about the problem. But then we get this tender pack, it's been rushed out, it's missing some key information, and we just don't know what we need to do to develop a solution. So I think, as Dan said, it's you've got to invest the time, work out where you want to go, invest the time and effort explaining this clearly to your potential suppliers. Industry days, pre-market engagement are all really good ways of making sure we understand what it is you're trying to do. We can ask the right questions, and then we can step up to the challenge and use our technical and wider industry expertise to help work out how best to support you.
Dan, something you've spoken about before is thinking about the end at the beginning. What does that mean?
Yeah, so really we're talking about making sure that it's easier to move on from the next contract than it might be this one. So it's thinking about and anticipating what happens next. So what's going to come after this deal? And that can be really difficult for departments because the business is changing and technology strategy changes. But you don't need to be exact. It's about, you know, being directionally correct, so that you can put the right, you know, obligations on the supplier, the right rights to information into the contract to make moving onto whatever is next easier. So much risk in technology implementations is in the delivery and the transition rather than that sort of run phase. So whatever you can do to make sure that you smooth the way into what comes next is really important. And I also think that's really especially important these days when we think about our rights to information or ongoing use of intellectual property. So an example might be that the moves that lots of departments are making to the cloud. So really smart tech teams are thinking about what if we needed to move an element to a different supplier, you know, so what was our architecture need to look like to enable that? Because it's very easy to assume that you can swap cloud suppliers around. You know, are you really going to have that flexibility without having to enter a program of change to at least re-architect some aspects of that system?
And Dan, just going back to your point before, what do you see the correlation with people in running some of this stuff is? You said about transition being key in the project life cycle. Have you kind of observed any patterns in terms of the people running these things?
Yes, Chad, I do. And I think almost every program that we engage with could do with thinking about transition and how things are going to be delivered a little bit earlier and having a plan. It's, you know, it's sometimes quite easy to explain, you know, the shiny thing that you want or, you know, we want to move from this kind of system to that kind of system. But the really hard stuff tends to be in, you know, even, let's think about data, you know, prepping the data, cleaning it up, migrating data across, migrating users. There's always a bunch of problems that come up in doing that. Transition might seem a long way away when you're thinking about, you know, your strategic outline business case, but it's not too early to have a plan and a strategy for it at that stage. And I think that would give, you know, that should give, you know, those approving more confidence that you've really thought this through. And I'd hope, Suzanne, that it would give suppliers you know, more confidence that we'd really thought about what we wanted to do.
I think for us, it's helping us understand where you're trying to get to. And I think although effectively the government strategy is to effectively insource more, to build in-house capability, to use open standards to reduce vendor lock-in, actually how that's implemented and the assumptions they make do vary massively between departments. So I think be open about sharing your technology strategy with your suppliers, sharing your workforce plan. What are you planning to do if you're going to look around moving to AWS? Are you going to build AWS experts internally, or do you need the suppliers to keep running those kind of things for you? Another really key thing actually is understanding is where are the areas you've invested in and that you want to leverage? And quite often you might have got ServiceNow, you might have got Dynamics, you might effectively have a big open source stack. Actually, what are those things, and share those with suppliers. If we understand your estate, what you do, what skills you've got, what you want to invest in, how you're going to build up your internal workforce, it better enables us to behave like a partner in terms of going forward. And for us in particular, understanding how are those things going to be handed over. I've worked with a couple of customers in the past with some good examples. And I had one where we were asked to respond to a competitive tender, and the customer wanted us to make effectively a technology choice at the end of discovery and then stick with that for the life of the contract. We didn't know what the legacy estate was. We didn't know how they'd support it. There was no facilitation for discussion. And they were clear they wanted to buy and configure rather than build, but they gave us no context around what they'd want to do or how it would work. And that they were making those decisions at the wrong stage. There are decisions you can outsource to industry and the decisions that you as government need to make yourself. And I think things such as, am I going to use this particular product or not this particular product? If your intention is to run it yourself downstream as government, you need to be part of that decision-making piece. So one of the key things we're often interested to know is, who are the people you're going to give to work to us? How are we going to make decisions? How are we going to do things together to make sure at the end of the contract you end up with something that you've got and you can run and you can operate, or you can break up in the ways going forward? I've also worked on a number of contracts where there's been an intention from the government department to transition that service and pick it up at the end and run it internally. But actually, you haven't invested the time in bringing those people on early enough. A really good project is when actually we're landing and we're the project team, we're providing that heavy lift capacity to get the build. But actually, your team, they're going to run it, are coming in during that life of the project. They're working with us. We're doing that upskilling. We're doing that handholding. And we're making sure that as we back out of the contract, you've really got it and you can grip it. And it's really common that the intention's there that government will run these contracts, but actually you haven't invested in the people and the skills to pick them up. And you know, there's a long tail on the end where you're not happy that you haven't got what you want. And actually we're not happy because we haven't been able to give you what you want.
I think it's best to take a step back, first of all, and consider the actual intent. Is it something new, or is this procurement intended to help, say, or remediate legacy technology, for example? And if that is the case, what's the strategy around that? There's a number of ways in the centre of government, cabinet office and others to help with both procurement and technology advice and the development of that strategy in itself. So there's Crown Commercial Services, for example, and Dan works in government commercial function. These are all quite complex landscapes with numerous stakeholders. So the important bit there is trying to get the insurance engagement correct and to try and bring those people in to really develop the procurement and route to market to ensure and instill competencies made in that particular area. Digital outcomes and specialists can be massively quicker and cheaper than others. And other routes through our frameworks or with the help of Dan and team, for example, a little bit more complex, but working together hand in hand with the different functions and the key stakeholders in the department will really help surface these particular ways. You spoke a little bit about data before, and it's important to highlight the technology code of practice, for example, isn't a checklist, and we should never really look at these things as a kind of a tick box exercise, because as Dan has already mentioned, the service standard and the technology code of practice look at the holistic trajectory of a piece of technology and the different component parts within that. So data is one. Who owns IPR, for example? Capability they're in, and I think kind of trying to live and breathe the technology code of practice and the service standard, weaving that in how and where we go to market and how we bring and work with suppliers will really help us move at pace and actually deliver the outcomes expected.
Dan, I wonder if you could explain for listeners what is Evergreen in IT?
Evergreen's been a pretty common term in IT and IT contracting for sort of over 20 years now. And indeed, most of the technology contracts that I've been involved with have sought to be evergreen. So we've sought to understand how that technology keeps up to date over time and trying to embed processes to deliver that and the cost in it. And you know, it's my experience that CIOs, you know, generally like to be running the up-to-date stuff, right? They like to be running new stuff. They prefer not to be running, you know, old and outdated stuff and all the problems that comes with that. The really big issue I've found with Evergreen is that we'll change those contracts in pursuit of short-term savings. So, you know, every year, you know, money's tight and, you know, the CFO comes along and asks some money out of the tech budget. And so the CIO say, okay, well, I've got this choice. We can stop this build program that's building something that the minister would like, or we can take some money out of our run budget. And 99 times out of 100, it's, well, take some money out of your run budget. So you look at your contracts now, you go to your suppliers and say, right, how can you help us to reduce our spend? And very often the answer is, well, look, if we change this contract, you know, we could delay some technical refreshes. We could not move on to this new version of a platform, and that would allow us to take some money out. So we, you know, we start off with great intentions of evergreen contracts, and then, you know, in the reality of cost cutting, we break them apart and they don't become evergreen. And actually, a lot of the big legacy issues in government that I've seen, you know, they started out as contracts that were supposed to be evergreen, and 10 years later, they're not, because we've broken into it and stopped refreshing technology. Yeah, and therefore, before you know, so you're out of date, you're out of support, and really importantly, often, you know, you're not cyber secure. You know, it doesn't take getting too many versions of certainly OS and other software behind, and you're completely out of cyber security support as well.
The amount of times I've been called into projects where actually the system, everything has suddenly got desperately, desperately, desperately urgent because the version they've got is really old and really outdated. And actually, that's one of the key things I still talk about is pace. So I suspect Dan and Chad will be wetting themselves up when I start talking about agile and service manuals being a new trend. And I think if you're in one of the big government departments, actually, this is now business as usual. You've done it. You understand what GDS want to achieve. You've got teams of 3,000 people internally. And this is the way you do business. You break things down to small problems and you just get on and start. But actually, my experience is a lot of the smaller departments are still just not there. I worked with a customer recently who was talking about actually moving, when their existing contract ended, moving to cloud. He said, well, it's going to take me 2 years to do the design work. So that you're kind of missing the point here. The whole thing about the change that came from GDS back in 2014, so this is now a long time ago, is breaking down the problem, starting early, getting things in front of users, doing technology spikes and finding out if things work by trying them. And it is staggering to be still sort of 7-8 years after that, and a lot of departments are still not doing it. They're still scared to make decisions. They're still scared to break things down. So I think my big thing is just get on and do it. Don't spend 3 years doing a massive big upfront design work and discovering everything. 3 years what it is. Actually think about what are those tech spikes? What are those de-risking things? What can you put in front of users? How can you break the problem down in a small way? Get things in front of users. Test the technology, see if it works. If you're looking at a low-code platform, the best way to find a low-code platform is going to work for you is actually do some experimentation. And the other thing there is accept the fact that actually the whole point of the service manual approach is that you do experimentation, and sometimes the experiment proves something works, and sometimes the experiment proves something doesn't work. And that's just as important as those times that it does. So actually, as Dan said, a lot of these decisions are really big decisions to make. The best way to make the decision is by actually to get a small pilot out there, get something out in front of users and use it. If you're trying to decide which ERP system to use it, don't spend 3 years writing requirements and run a big procurement. Actually test, pilot, put things in front of users and work out which one's the best match for your business. I think the other thing I just want to mention is in terms of new trends is that thinking about what are the components in the architecture, components in the system. Don't leave everything locked in together. If you've got sort of document management or you've got different components in it, think about how you want to decouple those things going forward. How do you want a more flexible architecture? Then as things move on and things change, you're not buying another big black box system for the next 10 years, whether you've built it or a supplier has. Actually, how do you make sure you've got loose coupling within the systems so you can change and move components as technology changes and moves on?
The more important bit is quite rightly what Suzanne said, is about how you investigate and explore some of those bits and have the expectation of throwing them away if they, for example, don't work in your particular program. There's a real element around risk, for example. So if recent data suggests perhaps government's IT estate is like 50% old legacy in needing remediation, for example. People think sticky plaster is new technology, like using automation and batch processing to essentially provide some cement over the top of some really creaky old stuff, as opposed to prioritizing the old stuff, for example. So that there needs to be a mixed approach to technology choices in the aspiration to move away from legacy architecture.
Can you describe some of the red flags you see when it comes to legacy IT and potential contracts with suppliers?
Certainly, continuing the thread before, there's a big kind of hole in understanding about legacy technology and the focus on trying to ensure legacy technology is identified within portfolios in it so that it can be remediated and prioritized correctly. I keep on accentuating the word prioritize because it's a really, really important element. There's still areas of silo-based thinking. So red flags are programs and portfolios working individually as opposed to looking at, across other areas within their business to identify common components or codes that can help move them away, for example. There's a big bit in our IT procurement red flags, which is around extensions. So typically if departments, agencies, etc. come to our team with extension requests, it's a red flag because it perhaps hasn't showed a developed strategy of how they want to move off of some of the older legacy technology, for example. We've been developing for a number of years a pipeline approach, which is data-centric and showcases all legacy technology, particularly costs across the department to ensure that they're prioritised correctly.
Dan, what should leaders make sure is included in the invitation to tender process?
It's really important to explain the context, and I think I've alluded to that before. So if you're not 100% certain on your requirements, well, be honest about that in your documentation. We think these are our requirements, and reflect that, you know, in your ask to the market. Loads and loads of value in our experience is it goes missing from deals when basically we change our mind once we sign the contract. And, you know, God bless suppliers, but, you know, they're commercial organizations and change comes at a cost. Also, get the right data in the documentation and the data room. Assumptions are an absolute killer. So both to delivery and value for money and indeed relationships. So if you're asking suppliers to make a bunch of assumptions when they come to price and solution, some are unavoidable. But when you're speaking to a supplier about, well, you know, why is this costing so much? Well, because we assume this. Well, you know, how do you make that assumption go away? Because that's some of the easiest ways to reduce price is to make assumptions go away.
I have to admit, when thinking about this question, I had to then rationalise my thoughts because I had too many things to talk about. I think the biggest bit of advice I'll give it is put yourself in the shoes of the supplier and imagine how are they going to respond to this? What are they going to do? What are they going to know? I think one of the key things you need to understand is this is an exam question for suppliers. So you are setting as an exam question and we're going to respond to it. And we will answer the questions that you have asked us, and we can only answer the questions that you have asked us, and you evaluate us on a level playing field against our other suppliers. So if you've missed things out, we might know that you need to integrate with a separate identity provider, or you've got these problems over here because we've been thinking about the problem we've been talking to before. But actually, if you don't ask it, we can't price it in. And I remember the number of times I've had discussions going, but I need to price this in. I want to come and do it. And the feedback I get from the rest of the team is, yeah, but you won't win. So we want to do the work, we want to help you, but we can only respond to you against the criteria that you've set. So some really great examples I've seen. I mean, the right data and the documentation. I remember seeing a tender where the customer wanted a user-based pricing model. So we had to give them a price based on a per user cost. And they couldn't tell us whether they're going to have 10,000 users or 20,000 users. From our perspective, 90% of the cost of the system were fixed. But they wanted 100% user. I mean, that is just completely insane to think, how is this going to work? How are we going to manage the risk? I think one of the key things, though, is, as Dan mentioned, it is that capacity to deal with change. Unless it's a really, really simple thing you want to do and it's really quite a short contract, what you're looking for is a partner to go on the journey with you. And one of the key things is, again, tenders I worry about are ones where they're not asking questions which assess how is this organisation going to behave as a partner like me as my needs changes? How will they manage change? And it's asking things like, how will you handle change? Have you got evidence from previous contracts that you will do what you say you would do? Or are we going to end up in change control hell? And I'll talk a bit later about what change control hell has felt for me. Explain clearly about, and also explain clearly what people you are putting in and how you will work with a supplier. One of the things we often do as suppliers is when you send a tender out and we look at it and we think, you've missed some really important things in here. Because we know if we don't cost those important things, your budget's going to be wrong and we're going to end up in a difficult situation. We will ask you tactical questions to try and nudge you towards telling everybody else about that thing. So when suppliers ask questions during the tender stage, look at them really carefully and think, what are they trying to say? So things like, are you sure you haven't asked this? We're often saying, we think you've missed something out. Go and have a look, go and have a think. And when you're not answering those questions well and you get an order of magnitude and difference price, that's often the reasons why. So I think my last one is rate cards. And I think a really simple rate card is a very blunt way of assessing price. And in some ways it's a race to the bottom. And I think from a supplier perspective, if it's a really complex project and actually you think it's too hard to come up with a pricing model that works and you go in with just a rate card model and it's 60% priced, you'll probably find a lot of the higher quality suppliers will just not bid because it's a race to the bottom on price. This is one of my pet hobby horses.
My favourite point of yours there, Suzanne, was the bit about pricing models. And whilst we talk about requirement documents and strategies, we seem to get higher and higher when we forget actually everything we're building will serve a user at some point. So be that a civil servant user or a member of the public, for example. A lot of packages out there, for example, have good pricing models and not even offer free, for example, for a limited number of users, which may seem okay to play about and test with some stuff. But if there isn't further consideration about the true extent of users, and when you're talking about a departmental level, that can really stack up, and then the costs can quickly be a magnitude of those. And that's an important thing to always consider, I think, as well.
Yeah, licensing costs be the thing that can cause all sorts of problems downstream. And particularly if you've got a supplier, I mean, quite often one of the benefits of government is with a lot of those big suppliers, you're negotiating license agreements that sit across multiple departments. So actually you can be reasonably sure if you get a license cost here, it'll roll over there. But I have seen instances where suppliers have, they've gone for the, effectively they're buying a third party license. And then in year two of the deal, the third party license, which is passed straight onto government, increases by order of magnitude. So yeah, if there's licensing costs involved, you need to be really clear about how does it work, how is it driven by users, and in particular licensing models that are driven by the numbers of citizen users can be massively cost prohibitive.
It's been highlighted that digital teams need commercial skills and commercial teams need digital skills, but it's still rare to find individuals who have both the skill sets. Dan, in a multidisciplinary team, who would you encourage to take a government commercial course and vice versa? Who on the commercial side should upskill in digital?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my overall recommendation is I think it's really important that people from digital, project, business and commercial understand enough about each other's world so you can build effective teams. So I think my advice is we should all try and get as rounded as we can. It's really important that our commercial people know enough to at least ask smart questions of our tech colleagues. So, you know, do I and my colleagues need to know the ins and outs of, say, software-defined networks or containerization? No, not really. But we do need to know enough to ensure that we understand the implications of that technology on the landscape and commercially, and that we're considering it for the right reason. And actually, I think sometimes, you know, we've got an advantage. We can ask sort of dumb questions, you know, of tech folks because, you know, we're not expected to be experts. And one of the things we invest on in the government in the government commercial function is spending time learning about technology, trends in technology and changes in the market. And we work with GDS, with CCS, and a lot with the market in order to get this knowledge. And I think that's super important. And I think it's also really important that we encourage, and I know GDS do and smart folks in departments do, is building a network of people you can just talk to about this. You know, can you get a phone a friend? I've working advising a department at the moment on quite a complex technical issue. And there were folks in departments who I knew a lot about this issue that we could rope in and have an interview with and share some knowledge. And I think that's really important.
Chad, do you agree? What can leaders do to support their teams upskilling?
Well, I think I absolutely do agree. On the one hand, you can't expect anybody to know absolutely everything about technology. It's simply not possible. Similar to what Dan said, I would highlight it's really, really important in how you envelope and support particularly individuals delivering technology to ensure they have a kind of a broad range of different disciplines and capabilities working hand in hand on the team, and also perhaps with the suppliers to resolve like legacy technology, for example. We talk a lot in our standards about minimum viable products, MVP, but you can have very much the same approach to an actual team spread across standard digital data technology capabilities, i.e. specifically architecture, design, research. If you then augment those and work hand in hand with categories like commercial, legal, technical, operational and delivery, you are very much looking at the end-to-end of that particular service to provide input and contribution to onboarding and ensuring the supplier actually provides their products and solutions in a way that complies with standards and a clear understanding of legacy technology. In terms of actual upskilling, there's a range of facilities and courses now available on civil service learning and also through Government Digital Services Academy that very much can take a commercial individual and give them some of the rounded knowledge or in terms of agile and delivering against the service standard. And also more senior leaders in technology to help with specific technology areas of focus. There's also widening support across government on themes like data, like Dan said, about tapping into different knowledge networks to really expedite upskilling.
Really, really poor contracts and poor supply relation management is where effectively there is a massive gap between the commercial team and the delivery team. One of my most difficult examples in my sort of career with government was effectively a contract that had come out that this particular department was the first time they'd let an agile delivery contract. It hadn't gone out via traditional framework. It was 250 pages long. It took us 3 months of clarifications to get to the point we could sign. And there was a lot of stuff in there, which was just boilerplate from old contracts that had been bunged in. And my view was actually when you dug into that and they hadn't provided the contract at tender stage, which was not helpful, but actually it would have needed three people just to manage the commercial process they were signing up to. So a really poor, poor, poor contract example. And the epiphany there was, I think we're negotiating this. We'd been at it 6 weeks, the week before Christmas. So what did the delivery team think about some of these controls? And the commercial team went, we haven't asked them. And they put a lot of controls in place.
And that effectively draws us to our close. Thank you so much to our panel. You've been great and provided some real valuable insight and advice of how to avoid getting yourself into a legacy IT contract, but also what to do if you already find yourself there.
Within this series, we also have two other podcasts, with one looking at the support leadership requires to address legacy IT, and one looking at why end users are key to solving legacy IT and moving to digital transformation. We encourage you to listen in to get a real feel for ways in which government organisations can make the best of digital transformation. For further information and support on any of the points raised in this podcast, please contact the Central Digital and Data Office.